to disrupt.
Finally, we just have 30 seconds, but what do you hope to accomplish with this book that you co-edited?
I want to give everyone, including newcomers and young people, encouragement to look at the possibilities, to know that there's a lot we can do, to know that the future is not yet written. We're writing it with what we do or fail to do in the present, and to do everything they can.
Rebecca Solnit, we want to thank you for being with us, co-editor with Thelma Young Lutinatabua of the new book, Not Too Late, Changing the Climate Story from Despair to Possibility. Also, thank you to Renato Red Constantino, longtime Filipino climate activist who has an essay featured in the book. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a digital fellow. Check out democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. Masks and proof of vaccination are required at this time. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Once a Braided River on Tuesday, May 16th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Cinema 21 in Portland. Once a Braided River is a documentary film by Barbara Bernstein. The film tells the story of the Willamette River before it was transformed into a Superfund site. The documentary features community groups and activists working to replace the zone and explores their vision to reclaim this stretch of river as a place where people and wildlife can thrive. Again, that's Once a Braided River on Tuesday, May 16th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Cinema 21, 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, tear gas Tuesday during the 2020 racial justice protests in Portland caused severe and irreversible health effects, according to a new study.
Former Portland Police Union President Brian Hunziker resigns from the PPB after it was discovered he was dually employed in Clark County.
And 50 tribes and First Nations petitioned the United Nations to intervene against the Enbridge Line 5 pipeline.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 17th, 2023. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Josh Salem. The concentration of tear gas particles in a downtown racial justice protest in June 2020 was high enough to cause severe, irreversible health effects. That's according to a study released today by the human rights research group Forensic Architecture. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, says anything over 2 milligrams per cubic meter of tear gas is immediately dangerous to life and health. The group estimates the Portland Police Bureau's tear gas concentration on June 2nd had reached over 440 milligrams per cubic meter. That's more than 220 times the safe limit. An hour after police released that tear gas, estimated levels hit more than 2,200 times the safe limit nearby. The findings are the result of a years-long study. Forensic Architecture collected hundreds of videos from the June 2nd, 2020 protests, which became known among activists as Tear Gas Tuesday. They reconstructed 3 hours of that night. Weapons experts looked at public records, which detailed the munitions the police had available, and hours of video to estimate which type of chemicals were likely used in each instance. Their results are probably on the conservative side. The report says, quote, "The Portland Police Bureau used tear gas against civilian protesters in quantities which very likely significantly exceeded federally recognized safe levels of airborne CS concentration for human exposure. At every location sampled by our methodology, those safe levels were exceeded," end quote. Portland police used three different types of riot control agents, commonly known as tear gas. These can be fired into crowds via eight different weapon systems, including grenades that disperse three tear gas canisters 20 feet in different directions when they detonate. Portland tried to disperse about 1,000 protesters that night, firing at least 138 chemical munitions over an 18-block area. The Portland Police Bureau did not respond to media questions about whether officers are trained on safe CS concentration levels and how or if they monitor those levels.
Company that makes most of the munitions Portland uses says CS gas can cause blisters, asthma attacks, shortness of breath, chest tightness, and feelings of panic. Other research into the side effects of tear gas has found it can cause inflammation and organ injury and has been linked to pregnancy loss. Throughout the 2020 protests, people reported various health impacts they believed were connected to tear gas exposure. A 2021 study by Kaiser Permanente Center for Health Research found that over half of the roughly 1,600 people who took their survey potentially had their menstrual cycle impacted. People described having itchy eyes and a scratchy throat when walking in areas where tear gas had been used the night before. Tear Gas Tuesday came early on what went on to be a nearly 200 days of sustained Portland protests for racial justice. They were originally sparked by George Floyd's murder at the hands of a Minneapolis police officer. Media reports from that night described, quote, "an indiscriminate barrage of grenades, kettling the crowd on all sides with walls of tear gas," end quote. Then Commissioner Joanne Hardesty called images of the event heartbreaking. Then Police Chief Jamie Resch, who stepped down 5 days later, defended the response, saying members of the crowd had thrown projectiles at officers. Police Bureau policies do require officers to consider proximity to homes, hospitals, and schools before using tear gas, and to minimize impact on people who are not being targeted. Video released with the study called the tear gas use indiscriminate. Days after the protest, U.S. District Court Chief Judge Marco Hernandez issued an injunction restricting the Police Bureau's use of the chemical agents. Hernandez later found the city in contempt for violating the injunction. A lawsuit brought by five protesters in the group Don't Shoot PDX was settled for $250,000.
The disgraced former president of the Portland Police Association, Brian Hunziker, has been put on leave by the Clark County Sheriff's Office effective last Saturday. This is the latest fallout for Hunziker after it was revealed that he had been simultaneously working for the Portland Police Bureau and Clark County Sheriff's Office. Hunziker had previously been fired from the PPB by Mayor Ted Wheeler last spring for falsely linking then-Commissioner Joanne Hardesty to a minor hit-and-run crash. An internal affairs investigation revealed Hunziker had violated two Bureau directives, the dissemination of information and discrimination, harassment, and retaliation, when he leaked a false lead identifying Hardesty as a subject. Hunziker admitted during the investigation that Hardesty's critical comments of policing during the Black Lives Matter movement in 2020 played a role in his decision. Hunziker was reinstated to the PPB in February by a state labor board arbitrator. Last week, Willamette Week notified the Portland Attorney's Office that Hunziker was also a Clark County deputy, forcing Hunziker to step down from the PPB on Thursday. Hunziker had been working as a sheriff's deputy in Clark County since last August, earning a near six-figure salary. Clark County would not comment on whether they were aware Hunziker was employed by the PPB at the time, saying they were conducting an internal investigation into the matter.
Making homes more resilient to fires could be a more effective way to defend communities against the destruction of wildfires than fire suppression alone. KBOO's Eric Leuschner has the details.
Wildfires are a growing threat in the Northwest, and a lot of money is spent on fire suppression, but a less costly approach could be to make homes and buildings more resistant to damage. Kate Anderson with Sightline Institute says fire hardening is far cheaper and more effective than trying to suppress fires far from a person's home. However, she says it's hard to change the mindset that we need to stop every fire and also stop the current wildfire treadmill that we're on.
By fighting every fire for over a century now, we've suppressed ourselves into a corner where even a small and innocuous fire can explode into an uncontrollable megafire.
Anderson believes fire hardening homes and communities is a cornerstone of climate resilience and adaptation, but the next step will be making it the new normal.
Short of living in a concrete bunker, we can't guarantee that our homes will survive a wildfire, but hardening them really improves their odds.
Anderson says some policies could help do this. Those include insurance discounts for hardened homes, requiring home sellers to disclose fire risk, and using public funding to boost hardening. However, she also notes making homes fire resistant has its limits.
People who live in fire-prone lands will come to see them as natural, just like many of the other rules and regulations we take for granted these days.
Anderson says Oregon should also adopt and enforce wildfire building codes. She says homeowners aren't internalizing the costs, and these codes would be helpful to address that in the long term. For KBOO News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Leuschner.
Transgender people are facing legislation restricting their rights across the country. But Washington state lawmakers have passed legislation supporting transgender youth, ensuring they don't go homeless. KBOO's Althea Billings has more.
As legislation across the country targets transgender people, Washington state lawmakers are moving in the opposite direction. The legislature recently passed Senate Bill 5599, which is designed to help transgender youth from becoming homeless. It also supports people in need of abortion care. State Senator Marco Leas, a Democrat from Everett, sponsored the bill.
Our trans youth who are seeking gender-affirming care, or any youth that's seeking reproductive health services that it's not safe for them to be at home, can stay in a licensed shelter or in a host home for a longer period of time with supervision by our Department of Children, Youth, and Families to make sure that they're safe.
Under the current law, young people can only stay in a shelter for 3 days without parental permission. 28% of LGBTQ youth report experiencing homelessness or housing instability at some point in their lives, according to a 2021 Trevor Project survey. The legislation also provides support for transgender youth who come from out of state. Leah says Washington state is making itself a welcoming place as other states move to pass harmful legislation, such as banning gender-affirming care for young people.
Especially at the national level where the headlines just can be so hopeless. There are places in this country that care about our trans community and are doing what we can to be supportive and ensure that they can be as successful as possible.
The legislation passed through the House last week. Washington's legislative session is scheduled to adjourn over the weekend. For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Althea Billings.
Idaho has taken steps to restrict the rights of transgender people. Eric Tagadoff speaks with Kate Bitz from the Western State Center, who says this effort is tied to a growing anti-democracy movement across the country.
Idaho lawmakers passed several measures this session that target transgender people. One group says this effort is connected to a wider movement to weaken democracy. One of the most controversial pieces of legislation passed was a measure that bans gender-affirming care for youth. But Kate Bitz with Western State Center notes this and other measures have been introduced in previous sessions.
What we're seeing is a culmination of some of the really horrible claims that we've seen made about transgender people over the past years. And obviously, this is a tragic situation for the entire community in Idaho, and especially for trans kids.
Bitz says Idaho is a bellwether for these issues, noting that state lawmakers passed legislation in 2020 that banned transgender athletes in school sports, a law that has become ubiquitous in Republican-controlled states. Bitz says these states have followed a template of sorts, introducing bills attacking the right to vote alongside the rights of transgender people.
These kind of repressive anti-transgender laws can't be divorced from attempts to make it harder for ordinary people to do things like run ballot measures, access quality public education, or even vote in primary elections that can be very decisive for state and local politics.
Bitz says some people might feel like they aren't affected by anti-transgender laws, but she points to attempts in Missouri to defund public libraries because of a lawsuit challenging the state's ban of certain books, many of which feature LGBTQ characters.
It's pretty much a very slippery slope from people trying to create a panic about the idea that a transgender child can live their truth to your own kid being unable to participate in school sports because somebody decided that means you have to defund the entire public education system.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Supporters of abortion rights rally as the Supreme Court delays limiting medication. Republicans praise the Air National Guardsman accused of leaking classified documents. And a report from the Urban League cites threats to democracy for Black Americans. With those stories and more, it's Catherine Carley with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
You can gauge the strength of a democracy based on the strength of women in that democracy.
Vice President Kamala Harris told abortion rights supporters in Los Angeles they're facing a critical point in our nation's history. Activists rallied across the country as the Supreme Court intervened to give itself time to consider opposing court rulings on the abortion medication mifepristone. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham tells ABC News Georgia Congresswoman and fellow Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene shouldn't be praising the 21-year-old just arrested for leaking classified documents. He called Greene's remarks irresponsible.
There are military members serving today from Georgia and other places who are less safe because of what this airman did. There is no justification for this.
Greene says the Air National Guardsman was charged because he is white, male, and Christian. The leaked documents reveal details of NATO intelligence about the Ukraine war, as well as U.S. intelligence gathering worldwide.
And I say to my colleagues on the other side of the aisle that no matter what you vote, you have the votes, but you will not be victorious because there are generations of young people who see what is going on.
Tennessee Democratic State Representative Justin Jones says young voters will remember Republican efforts to stifle his voice by kicking him out of the legislature. A new report by the National Urban League calls undermining Black officials among the greatest threats to democracy. The report also cites efforts to exclude Black history from classrooms and attempts to restrict voter access. Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota tells ABC News that California Senator Dianne Feinstein made the right decision to step down from the Judiciary Committee.
If this goes on month after month after month, then she's going to have to make a decision with her family and her friends about what her future holds.
Feinstein is 89 and shows signs of decline, but Klobuchar says Democrats will need her vote soon to raise the debt ceiling. Fox News will defend itself in a Delaware courtroom today as trial starts on the $1.6 billion Dominion voting system's defamation suit. Dominion says it was damaged by Fox News hosts repeating 2020 election fraud conspiracy claims they knew were false.
If you're concerned about the Ukraine, we need to pass this bill. If you're concerned about feeding hungry people in this country, we need to pass this bill.
Democratic Montana Senator John Tester wants lawmakers to work together on an omnibus spending bill, but the GOP-led legislature back home aims to change primary rules to hobble him in next year's re-election bid. Minor candidates could drain GOP votes in Montana, so they want only the top two candidates to advance. And the city of Boston marks 10 years since the marathon bombing left 3 dead and nearly 300 injured. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 17th, 2023. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report about the Partnership for Safety and Justice's Advocacy Day in Salem on April 19th to lobby for criminal legal reform. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, let's talk about race. Tonight's weather will be steady rain leading into showers mixed with snow overnight. Tomorrow's weather will be a mix of rain and snow showers in the morning, changing to rain in the afternoon. Today in history, in 1961, Cuban exiles financed and trained by the CIA landed at the Bay of Pigs in Cuba with the ill-fated hopes of ousting then-Cuban Prime Minister Fidel Castro. The music accompaniment today is by American jazz pianist and educator Ahmad Jamal, who died yesterday at the age of 92. And the quote of the day is from deceased professional wrestler Rowdy Roddy Piper, who was born on this day in 1954. Piper said, quote, "They say that wrestlers are actors, They couldn't be more wrong. The truth is, wrestling and acting could not be more opposite. Wrestling is explosion, and acting is implosion.
Montana's legislature calls on the U.S. government to create a National Day of Remembrance for American Indian boarding schools. And the Coquille Indian Tribe calls Oregon Governor Tina Kotek's stance on gaming hypocritical. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
Montana's legislature has passed a joint resolution recognizing the history of American Indian boarding schools and calling on the U.S. government to create a National Day of Remembrance. Montana Public Radio's Ellis Julin has more.
Democratic Representative Tyson Running Wolf, a member of the Blackfeet Nation, sponsored the resolution in the House to officially acknowledge the trauma of boarding schools.
They suffered physical, sexual, cultural, and spiritual abuse and neglect, inexperienced treatment that in many cases constitute torture. For speaking their native language, many children never returned home, and their fates have yet to be accounted for by the U.S. government.
On the House floor last week, Running Wolf read off a list of 13 children from tribes across Montana who died at the Fort Shaw Industrial Indian School, an hour east of Helena.
The school was opened between 1892 and 1910. The youngest to attend the boarding school was 4 years old.
Senate Joint Resolution 6 passed with bipartisan support in both the House and Senate. In 2021, U.S. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland launched an investigation into the country's past assimilation policies, which included the forced removal of Native American children from their families and tribes, placing them in Indian boarding schools. That ongoing investigation found 18 boarding schools operated in Montana. For National Native News, I'm Ellis Julin.
Oregon Governor Tina Kotek's stance on gaming is hypocritical, says the Coquille Indian Tribe. The criticism follows a letter she recently sent to the nine tribes across the state. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
In her letter, the governor writes that she does not favor the expansion of gaming, and therefore her policy maintains the status quo from previous administrations. Kotek then highlights the Coquille Tribe's application for an electronic bingo facility in Medford and states her opposition to it. That stirred up strong feelings and resentment among some who point to a broad array of state-sponsored gambling in Oregon. John Ivey is vice chair of the Coquille Tribal Council.
Truly, the Oregon Lottery is the biggest gaming institution in the state of Oregon. Maybe there's some political gamesmanship going on here when, in fact, it is frustrating and, quite frankly, somewhat hurtful to the tribe.
The tribe says Kotek has no authority over the matter, and her stance perpetuates a mythical one tribe, one casino policy. The Coquille Tribe has sought federal approval for a Medford gaming facility, which would be its second one outside the Mill Casino in North Bend, Oregon. Previous governors have not supported it, and the Cow Creek Band of Umpqua Indians, which runs the Seven Feathers Casino in Canyonville, has also opposed it. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The governor's office did not respond to KLCC's request for comment. A man with strong ties to the Western Alaska village of Gamble has been recognized for his commitment and dedication to Native culture and identity. Sam Schimmel is an Indigenous youth advocate who's Siberian Yupik and Kenaitse. He'll soon graduate from law school. Schimmel's the inaugural recipient of the Autumn Opok Ridley Award, given by the Alaska Native Heritage Center in Anchorage. Schimmel's recognized for his work in supporting Indigenous culture and ways of life. He says listening closely to elders as a youth, as he grew up in Gamble and on the Kenai Peninsula, was one of the most important touchstones of his life.
They're the ones who instilled in me the promise of reciprocity that our communities are based on, the idea that our elders will teach us how to live and how to be. In exchange, when we grow up, we will take care of our elders and we will pass down that knowledge onto our children so that they will take care of us.
Schimmel received the award last week. The Heritage Center's inaugural community recognition includes an elder award, which was given to the late Dr. Oliver Levitt. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Representatives of more than 50 tribes and First Nations have submitted a petition to the United Nations to intervene on their behalf with Canada over the Enbridge Line 5 pipeline. Mark Richardson has the details.
Representatives of 51 tribes and First Nations have presented a demand to the United Nations to call on Canada to end its support for the Enbridge Line 5 oil pipeline. In a petition to the UN's Human Rights Council, the coalition claims the pipeline is a threat to the human rights of frontline indigenous communities and to the environment. It claims the tribes and entities of the U.S. government have agreed to talks to settle the dispute. Still, Canada has consistently invoked a 1977 pipeline treaty, blocking any meaningful progress. Whitney Gravel is president of the Bay Mills Indian community, says it's about maintaining their sovereignty.
Ultimately, the reason we're involved is in order to protect the future of not only the state of Michigan and the water quality of the Great Lakes, but also to continue to protect the future of our indigenous lifeways.
Line 5 moves crude oil from Canada to Michigan underneath the Straits of Mackinac. The controversial project has been the target of multiple environmental groups and tribes over concern that a spill could pollute much of the Great Lakes. A request to the Canadian Foreign Ministry seeking comment was not returned. Gravel says that this week, representatives of the coalition will travel to New York to present their grievances to the UN's Permanent Forum on the Rights of Indigenous People, which oversees treaty disputes.
So no one understood the consequences that would be placed upon Indigenous people throughout the state of Michigan, throughout the Great Lakes, really, by placement of these pipelines.
She says the tribes and First Nations have grown weary of trying to get Canada to live up to its obligations and hopes the United Nations can intervene and move the parties toward a settlement.
The government of Canada is really speaking with two faces. On one hand, they are intervening in domestic litigation to support Enbridge Energy. They are delaying the court proceedings from being able to be adjudicated. We are suffering harm as a result.
For Michigan News Connection, I'm Mark Richardson.
Montana Republicans are trying to block third-party candidates from next year's U.S. Senate election. Many feel the proposal is a means of consolidating the opposition to incumbent Senator John Tester in a race vital to control of that legislative chamber. State-level Republicans want to alter the 2024 Senate primary so that only the top two candidates, no matter their party, move on to the November election. Past races for his Senate seat were very close. Many blame third-party candidates for siphoning away potential Republican votes and giving Tester, the only Democrat to hold statewide office in Montana, that elected position. Libertarians and Democrats blasted the proposal as a blatant attempt to rig the election. Democrats currently hold a 51-49 U.S. Senate majority. They will be defending 23 seats next year, many in states like Montana, West Virginia, and Ohio, all of which have grown increasingly Republican. The GOP is defending 10 seats and will also try to flip seats in swing states like Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Republicans want to deny Tester a fourth term after GOP candidates dominated recent elections in Montana. Supporters of the bill claim they simply want to stop Republicans and Democrats alike from trying to manipulate elections by stealthily promoting third-party candidates.
Emails associated with the bill show that longtime Republican lobbyist Chuck Deneau helped shape the measure. The current version of the bill would sunset after the 2024 Senate election, but lawmakers have been considering an amendment to the bill that would continue on for future Senate races. Primary races for other seats would be unchanged in 2024, with voters in each qualifying political party continuing to select their own candidates for the general election. The state Senate approved the 2024 primary change by a 27-23 vote last week. Seven Republicans joined all of the chamber's Democrats in voting against the measure. The Montana House State Administration Committee votes on the measure and the amendment today. Both major parties in Montana have tried to use third parties to their advantage in past elections. For example, a Democratic-linked group promoted Libertarian candidate John Lamb as the race's true conservative in an effort to siphon off conservative votes in a House race. The Republican sponsor of the proposed primary changes, State Senator Greg Hertz, said, quote, "Some major parties probably want to continue doing this, including my own. Let's get away from this, what the two major parties are doing in Montana." End quote.
Outdoor fitness retailer REI will close its only remaining store in Portland in February 2024, according to an announcement today. The company emailed REI members, saying the location could no longer guarantee the safety of employees and customers. Last year, on Black Friday, a car was used to break the store's doors, and then clothing was stolen. The email said, quote, "The safety of our employees, members, and customers is always our number one priority. In recent years, Portland has been dealing with increased crime in our neighborhood and beyond. Last year, REI Portland had its highest number of break-ins and thefts in two decades, despite actions to provide extra security," end quote. Walmart also closed its last two Portland locations last month, although the chain cited poor sales and not security reasons as the underlying cause. REI does not believe opening a new site in downtown Portland is likely. Suburban Portland area REIs will remain open in Tualatin, Hillsboro, and Clackamas.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News from Monday, April 17th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes my co-anchor Josh Salem, myself, Karen James, and Eric Leuschner. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Arthur Risotto. Special thanks to Eric Tagadoff, Catherine Carley, Antonia Gonzalez, and Mark Richardson. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The Oregon Legislature is in session, and among the many bills introduced are bills to reform public safety and the criminal legal system. So here to talk about their legislative agenda and their advocacy day in April are folks from Partnership for Safety and Justice, Talia Gadd and Babek Zolbagari-Azar. So, Talia, Babek, safety and justice advocacy